Dubai Eye 103.8.
Keith Littlewood is a rehabilitation and performance coach who specializes in pain relief, movement, energy, digestion. You can find him at Tom Littlewood on Instagram. Also, Keith Littlewood, coaching.com, the website, and balancedbodymind.com as well to get all the latest. Or just keep listening for the next hour or so because he's live here in studio. Keith, lovely to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
Nice of you to join us this morning. Thank you so much indeed for being with us. Busy time of year for you?
Yeah, I've got lots of things going on. Teaching of courses, finish up my master's degree, which has taken 2 years with a postgrad diploma. So glad to get that out of the way and get purely back into work and reading again.
We were just musing a few moments ago about all things beaches. Is that one of those things that for somebody who is so invested into healthy body, healthy mind, what you put into your body, etc., what you do with yourself, do we take enough advantage? Do you personally take enough advantage of the coastal areas here?
Yeah, and I work with a lot of clients who don't get that time, and it's essential. Just instead of just exercising, going down to the beach and walking barefoot on the beach and having the salt in the air is actually quite calming to the nervous system.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. It's shown to lower the stress that our body goes through physiologically. It's well known that salty foods lower the stress response. So even breathing in salt can have that beneficial effect. But just being closer to nature, there's quite a lot of research that shows that people that walk in nature do much better from a stress relief perspective than people who run in nature. And certainly people who run in, say, urban areas. So there is a good thought process about being more connected with the surroundings and getting back to kind of being exposed to kind of nature, whether it's the sea, whether it's a beach, whether it's greenery in the mountains. So I advocate it, and we try to get down to the beach at least once a week.
There are those that say there is too much salt in the water here. Can there ever be too much salt in water? Because there has been research and there's been suggestions in the past that swimming in salt water is better for you than swimming in chlorinated water. It's good for healing of cuts. It's good for healing of sores as well. Is there anything in that?
Certainly, if you're swimming in it, you wouldn't want to drink it, that's for sure. But, but certainly swimming in it, I can't see any harm. The body can absorb a certain amount of product through the skin, but yeah. I don't think it's going to be you can bathe in very heavily salted waters. I think they do it in flotation tanks as well sometimes, right?
Exactly.
The Dead Sea was always well known for its healing properties, so I don't think having too much salt. There tends to be a bit of a misnomer about salt and heart health, and there's even quite a few studies that have shown going low salt can be quite harmful to the body. So actually keeping a modest intake of salt is actually quite helpful.
We're in conversation with Mr. Littlewood. He's here in studio working through a couple of these stories that Keith has picked up for us, and stories that are all too often stories that we hear again and again and again, none more so than plastic bags. Why, Keith Littlewood, are we still at this point, coming towards the end of 2018, why we're having a debate about plastic bags at the moment?
I don't know, and I was kind of thinking, should I send this in? Because I remember it's been covered by multiple people over the last few years about why it's still happening. But looking at this article in The Guardian, about 110,000 tonnes of plastic bags being produced for supermarket use. The dent seems to be almost insignificant, and maybe that comes from an education perspective, maybe that comes from perhaps providers of plastic bags not being more forceful in saying, you know, you need to do something about this as well. And I think, you know, I sometimes forget, but most of the time I have a couple of bags in the car for when I just need to pop into the shops. And that's the problem, is a lot of people are out and they don't want to carry bags around with them because it's inconvenient. But you see so much plastic littered, whether it's the beaches, whether it's the desert. I remember a couple of years ago going out driving in the desert, and I came across a camel carcass that was splayed out. It must have been there a couple of years. But in the middle of where its stomach and where it's around its spine, there were 40 or 50 or what looked like a huge mass of plastic bags. And some might say, well, they could have just blown there. But it was actually in the internal compartment of where the stomach would have been. And it's quite likely that this camel would have died. I've actually got the picture on Instagram somewhere if you scroll back through it. But you can see this mass that's hidden underneath some of the kind of the spine and in where the digestive system would have been. And it's everywhere. And I think people get used to just kind of assuming that dropping a bag or dropping a plastic bottle has no impact. But then you go in different areas and you see it accumulates in a variety of places. And until people start to perhaps take on board that it is quite damaging, you know, and it's an attitude thing. You still, people who go perhaps smoke and go to the beach, who are quite happy just to flick cigarette butts on the beach still. And I think when they do the pickups recently, they still picked up tens of thousands of cigarette butts. And it's the same thing about what you're dropping has a huge impact on the environment and the ecosystem around you. And I just don't think people, there's a lot of people who do get it, but there's still a lot of people that it's just, it's not. It's an afterthought.
So interesting, because I had this only yesterday. I went popped into the petrol station, the gas station, whatever you want to call it, on the way home, just to grab some bits and pieces that we needed for lunchboxes and bits and whatever it was, just basics. I didn't have much. I just literally was in front of a guy who was buying one bottle of water, and the person that was the cash attendee who was looking after the counter said, "Would you like a bag with that?" And he said, "Yes." And it just really struck me in that moment, because I refused my bag and sort of wandered out with my arms full of bits and pieces and goodies. But they insisted, the fella in front of me insisted on a bag. Now, who am I to judge him? But again, that was that sort of that education, not so much education. Well, I suppose it is education of plastic pollution. But the fact that for him, he thought it was part and parcel of what he was paying for. If he was going to pay £3.25 or £3.25 for a bottle of water, he wanted the bag that it came with.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, like you say, perhaps not education, more of an awareness of again, the environment around you. But why is it necessary? And maybe perhaps supermarkets should be holding back and not offering bags for simple purchases or one or two items. I mean, you know, when you go there and you'll get maybe sort of a shop and you haven't got your bags, they'll often put like two or three things in the bag. Yeah. And I try and, if I have ever forgotten my bags, try and get as much in there till it's about ready to burst. That has played against me sometimes when the bottom of my bags went spilling all over the floor in the car park. But at the end of the day, you know, it's making the effort to kind of reduce the amount of plastic in the environment.
But isn't the onus therefore down to the supermarkets, to the Enox, to the Adnox, to the suppliers of these bags, not suppliers as in makers or producers, but those that are giving them to us, to just stop giving them to us?
I think so. I think and also maybe even charging more for plastic bags. I mean, if you keep putting the price up and saying, you know, the more that you keep using these bags, the more it's going to keep costing you. Maybe that's the impact that people need to make the change. Some people might say, oh, that's just being controlling or that's being authoritarianism. Well, actually, it is something that seems to persist. And if you look at the masses in the oceans and in the environment, you don't have to walk too far to see evidence of wasteful plastic use. And people keep saying, we keep going on about it, but it doesn't seem to really change that much. So I think more needs to be done.
And just do it as well. Again, another example. This is not me spending my entire life on the forecourts of gas stations, I promise you. But again, this is something I had that little moment where I filled up the car the other day, went out to get some cash, came back, saw the amount. I always tip the guys that fill the car anyway. But when he gave me the bill, it was bigger than the amount that was that was showing on the pump. And I questioned him on that. I said, it's more. He said, oh, yeah, I cleaned your windshield, sir. I said, oh, that's a new thing. What you're now charging for cleaning the windshields without even asking us, that's fine, no problem at all. Take it on. It's a service that you've supplied. More than happy to give the extra couple of dirhams for that. But that was at no point has that been sort of broadcast or made clear to me. It was just, if that is now the policy, it might not be. It might just be having a bit of a laugh with me. But if that is now the policy, again, that's something that's being done without, we just accept it.
Yeah.
So why don't we do the same with plastic bags?
Yeah, I mean, that's
charge for them.
Yeah, very good point. Yeah, why don't we do that? I mean, it's not like it's something that's actually going to cost us anything in the long run. It's going to make the environment much better. And when we think about what it's doing to the environment and our health, people don't often think about, oh, well, if you drop plastic bags, but what's it doing to the water supply?
Yeah.
What's it doing to the air? And there's a lot of plastics in the air that seem to cause problems as well. So when they degrade, we don't know where they're going. Well, we do know to a degree, but sometimes when they're kind of breaking down further, we can't just contain it in the soil and the water. It's going to go into the air as well.
Keith Littlewood is a rehabilitation and performance coach. He specializes in pain relief, in movement, in energy, in digestion. Keith Littlewood, and you can find out all about him at keithlittlewoodcoaching.com, balancedbodymind.com as well. We are talking, or have been talking, plastics. A number of you have been getting on the back of that one. Thank you to you all for those. Thank you to this one from one of our listeners saying, thanks for bringing up the use of plastic bags again. I don't think we can talk about it too much, as not enough people are making changes. I'm a mum who shops daily and all I see is plastic bags everywhere. Definitely people need to be charged. We should have adverts everywhere. We're coming up to Christmas and the awareness of wrapping paper not being recyclable also needs to be brought up. Thank you for that one. Thank you also to Michelle, who's been in touch, saying the poor servant at the gas station just gets shouted at if they don't give the free plastic bag for just a single purchase item. Indeed, charging is the only option. Michelle, thank you very much indeed for that one. And thanks also to Ryan as well. Ryan Ingram's been in touch with us this morning saying camels ingesting plastic when they feed out of waste skips, not from eating litter, not that I condone littering. I agree that supermarkets need to stop distributing plastic bags for free, but we also need to each play an active role in education of our community and support the spread of conscious consumerism. Ryan Ingram, we thank you very much indeed for that. Lots of thoughts, therefore, coming in on this one. Lots of thoughts, hopefully, coming in on our other subjects as well. Keith's here in studio with us. And the next story on our agenda today is, well, it's one that I'm... the jury's out for me on this one. Raw food, and eating of raw food. There are those that are devotees of raw food. Are they right? Are they at risk? Where are we at with the research on this one, Keith? Because obviously this is something that's been talked about a lot in recent times.
Well, I think it's always important to talk about context, where you are with one's health. I mean, we didn't have the capacity to cook many millennia ago. And so the argument is as we've evolved and as our brains have got bigger, that has actually come from a product of cooking. And also, but you know, we became more sociable when the very action of cooking started to occur. I think when we look at these days, there's a zeitgeist within nutrition to eat everything that's green and brown in its wholest state. But that can cause a lot of problems for many people. A lot of people have digestive issues, have energy issues, hormone issues. And filling up someone with lots of raw, green, hard, difficult to digest foods can be particularly problematic. I personally advocate eating plenty of easily digested ripe tropical fruits, some vegetables, good quality proteins and dairy products. But for some people, and you tend to see it in more kind of so-called more holistic circles, perhaps yoga practitioners as well, tend to eating a raw, vegan, vegetarian diet. But to be honest, I've worked with a lot of these people, and some of these people often have more digestive issues and more hormone and energy issues. So you have to take it from a context issue. Is what is that person? What's their health like? Do they have an absence of pain, good mood, good digestion, good sleep, good emotions, and functions like that? So if you're consuming a raw vegetable diet and you have really good health, you can't really argue with it. But if you're consuming it and you're having these issues, you have to kind of reevaluate what's going on. A lot of people make changes. So if you're an individual who's eaten lots of fast food for a long period of time, not many nutrients in, a lot of nutrients that perhaps disrupt your biology, switching to a diet, to another diet, will create some kind of change, most likely positive in the short term. But there will be a period where perhaps that change or artifact wears off. So you might have gone from high carb to low carb. You might have gone from meat eating to non-meat eating. You might have changed anything like that. So there will always be changes. So you probably have to look at what a diet's doing to you, say, 6 months to a year down the line, and maybe even longer. But there are some people who will do well on a raw food diet and some people that don't so much.
Is there not an element of cooking that is sort of part and parcel of the protection of food, or the killing off of potentially bad bacteria?
Well, I think that the pasteurisation is an interesting subject in itself. And we can look at the concept of, say, raw dairy, for example. Now, I advocated raw dairy for a number of years with clients. And I still, when I go back to the UK, I sometimes have raw dairy. But having pasteurised milk isn't going to do the problems that it says it does. Actually, kind of pasteurising milk for people who have sensitive digestive systems might actually make it easier to digest. I talk about the article, which the one... which we might be able to share, the Medscape one, about some people talking about the need for drinking raw water. And the experts were saying, well, you know what happens, why we clean water and why we tend to sanitize it is because there are lots of microbes in the water. And I think you just have to go to some underdeveloped areas to appreciate the need for having treated water. But I think with foods, some foods actually do much better when you cook them. You get more nutrients out of them. If you overcook foods, if you burn foods, you can destroy some of the nutrients and make more kind of nasty compounds when you overcook and burn them. But it really just depends on the food. I mean, for fruit, for example, some fruits are actually easier to digest. Apples, for example, although they have high amounts of pectin, sometimes that can be really irritable for the digestive system. And stewing apples, for example, is a really way to get nutrients and be able to digest them much better. So it really does depend on the type of food and what you're trying to achieve with it. But generally, people who I work with that have digestive issues, giving them plenty of easily digested food is a great way of getting nutrients.
So this Medscape article that you highlighted there, they were posing the question about the fact that raw food, whilst we see it as being part of a sort of food trend or certainly something that a lot of people are getting more aware of, and yet there could be the risk of contamination from raw foods as well.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about parasites in meat, for example, when it's undercooked. But if you haven't washed and looked after your vegetables properly and just pulling up fruit or just taking it without sometimes washing it, you're exposed to a number of microbes and intestinal worms that might be there. And depending on someone's biology, their digestive system, their ability to tolerate stress might dictate whether that kind of microbe or perhaps nematode or worm or something becomes problematic.
I'd love to get your thoughts on an article that's appeared or popped up on our screens, and I'm sure there are a number of other people out there that got questions for Keith, so feel free to get them in to us as well. You often see, and I mean, I don't need to tell you, there are no shortage of seasonal articles that come out, and around about this time of year, we're looking at winter. In many parts of the world, certainly in the Northern Hemisphere, where the temperatures are dropping, and therefore how can the seasons affect what we eat and what we put into our bodies? Should we go more seasonal with what we consume? There's a great piece out today saying that one of the superfoods or one of the buzzwords in the food industry this season is, of course, beetroot, and that's what we should all be consuming by the bucket load at the moment. In fact, nothing else but beetroot. Are you an advocate of all things beetroot? And do we run that risk if we've got this number of, I mean, this is one of four or five articles I found this morning about the benefits of beetroot, all written within the last 6 weeks or so. Do we run that risk of putting too much, if it's picked up by the right people, of putting too much pressure on beetroot producers?
Yeah, it's kind of wrapped up in a whole kind of ecological question more than anything else, isn't it? And perhaps the season that we're thinking about is, where's beetroot naturally grown? And what season? Is it a winter season? Well, it depends on where you are. What's the point of trying to extrapolate that kind of statement to somewhere perhaps out here?
Yeah.
Now, beetroot produces something called nitric oxide. Now, nitric oxide, whilst it's very good for kind of enhancing vasodilation or opening up of the arteries, which is associated with blood pressure issues, too much nitric oxide is extremely problematic for human health and is associated with disease states. So there's a fine balance with all of these things. It's a bit like saying you need to eat loads of nuts and seeds because they have high amounts of vitamin E in them. Well, the vitamin E is actually there to protect the oils in the nuts and seeds that can go rancid over a long period of time. So again, it's all about context. And that, I think the concept of a superfood has been hijacked by a number of organizations, as it were, to kind of describe what a specific nutrient is. But we need to have context to what the food's actually doing. And if you're saying about seasonal, I get what people talk about when they say eat seasonally. But over here, the season is very different to what you have in Europe. So that going around that particular scheme may not be as useful as we think it is.
This one's saying kale, Keith. Kale, Keith. Is it kale, Keith? It's like Caesar over there, isn't he? Kyle Keith. Is it better for you raw or cooked?
I would, if you really need to eat kale, a lot of the brassica and cruciferous vegetables have a lot of compounds that actually shut down your metabolism. So cooking them can help to free up some of that those compounds. So I'm not a big believer in eating lots of raw green vegetables, because I think the compounds for people that have energy and digestive issues are particularly problematic, and you won't find them being on my recommended food list if I'm working with a client like that. But to answer the question, cooked.
I'm going to talk civility in just a little while. Before we do that, though, I need a 101 on EDC. What's an EDC?
An EDC is an endocrine disrupting chemical.
Oh, of course it is, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously they're ubiquitous in the industrialised world that we live in now. A lot of people, common conception is like a plastic bottle. We know that plastics have an issue. We know that other pollutants. One that's in the air a lot is polymatic hydrocarbon, and these can be from plastics, from car exhaust, from industrial waste, and more importantly, actually, in your own home. If you have cleaners that come in and use lots of chemicals and pollutants, when you spray something, as soon as you smell it, it's hit your bloodstream. That's the idea of how we can absorb endocrine disrupting chemicals.
Really?
And people think about, well, okay, we can worry about everything. What we don't know about is we don't have any models that predict all of the pollutants together and how they function. And people that are more chemically disposed or have sensitive metabolisms or hormonal systems can be more influenced with these chemicals, for sure. And we know that the for example, the Endocrine Society has released a stand in 2015 saying that a lot of the pollutants that are in the air are well known to cause diabetes, well known to cause heart disease and cancers, and they're increasing, but the models for prediction are slightly harder to look at. So what we've got to start to consider is, what is someone's exposure? We know that in the air there's not a lot they can do. I know the government here is doing some great things about trying to get that down and becoming the greenest city in the world, which is a fantastic challenge to accept.
Yeah.
But you know, even in our own home, you know, the average person puts on quite a few hundred, maybe thousand chemicals before they've even left the door. What's in the shower gel? What's in the toothpaste? What's in some of the foods? And this might not affect the odd person, but for some people, being exposed to more and more pollutants can have a severe effect on one's health. And we talk about the cleaning products that people use, the Mr. Muscles and things like that. Probably shouldn't have mentioned the name, but that's the only thing I can think of. But, you know, these things, all of these can have an effect. And if we don't spend as much time in areas that have cleaner air, or if we don't expose ourselves to areas of more nature where there's more carbon sinks, there can be more problems associated with this.
I think I was doing that last night because one of those products that I was queuing at said petrol station for, which I'm not proud of, but I'd rather have it than the results of, was mosquito spray and repellent. Mm-hmm. And I found myself going, because we'd been absolutely bombarded the night before and things like that, I found myself going around rather militantly with my can of spray, trying to prevent the family being bitten. But as you just said, as soon as I smelt that, as much as they try and cover up the odour with nice smells and things like that, it's still quite acrid, isn't it?
Yeah, and literally you can go, I mean, for example, even, you know, public places like malls and stuff, everyone's spraying lots of different things into the air. There's the toilets, there's the individual stalls with the smells, and some of it's relatively organic and harmless, but a lot of the cleaning chemicals can pose a specific threat if you're exposed to them all the time. And that's the thing, is how much are you breathing in on a daily basis?
Yeah.
I always advocate with clients is having a couple of air filters at home, because if the very least at home is the place that you want to be spending the time to regenerate. So I always advocate having some good filters at home to clean the air. So at least when you're going home, you're resting and not being exposed to said bombardment. And just being mindful of the products that you use at home. And when you clean the place, or if you have cleaners that come in, the types of chemicals that they're being exposed to. Yeah. Because if you imagine, like, the cleaning companies here, someone's going into 6, 7, 8 different houses a day. I think some of the companies do actually recommend them to use masks.
Yeah.
Whether they use them or not is a different thing. But all of these things that accumulate within our environment have a specific effect on human health. And that's probably a representative.
You're listening to The Agenda.
It's all about your news and your views.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Right, well, let's wrap things up with our special guest, Keith, as he gets ready to bid us adieu. We've got one more story for you. If you'd like to get your thoughts into us on that one, we appreciate that. Do send them through to us on 4001. And the question we posed before we went to the break, Keith, was civility. Is civility a sham? Now, why is this a question that you've brought to the table today?
Well, I was quite interested in the concept of conversation, linguistics, and generally how we interact with people. And this TED talk with Teresa Bijan was really interesting because she was actually asked to talk about civility. And her book regarding civility was actually saying, well, actually, I think civility is a bit of a sham. However, if we can kind of make a distinction between just being civil for the sake of being polite versus a virtuous civility and actually engaging in proper conversation. I found that concept really interesting because more often than not, there's definitely a difference between people, how they act in social media compared to how they act in person. People will be more open to criticizing, stonewalling, shutting you down, with often out providing decent, adequate answers that lack any depth. Whereas in person, they might just go, yeah, okay, agree to the narrative and then just go back behind your back and just totally disagree with you. So I thought about making the distinction about conversations and how we can have better conversations throughout the world, whether it's religious tolerance, whether it's understanding environmental stimulus, whether it's disagreeing about medical procedures or nutrition. No, nutrition is the biggest dogma creating. It's a religion in itself. Is nutrition, isn't it? You'll often see very, very varying degrees, with often a lack of concrete evidence. So I think about if we are like this. Teresa Bijan says, I think it was a really nice conversation about if we are trying to understand each other, so we can live with each other better. Whether we have differences, is that we really make a better understanding of each other and what our differences are, so that at least we come to the table and say, do you know what, I agree with that, or I don't agree with that, and here are my reasons why I don't agree with it. Now, what do you think about that? Rather than going, yeah, okay, and then turning your back and saying something totally different. And I think it's about creating better quality conversations and probably a better tomorrow, because if we have a better understanding from where someone's coming from, it's going to create better stimulus for the future. Now, you can apply that whether it's environmental stimulus or individual relationships. Mm. And I found the difference between the two quite constructive.
It's a fascinating subject, and we're not going to do it justice in the couple of minutes we've got, but it is a great talker for people out there, because I've noticed this as well. And whilst we all are craving greater civility at the moment in our own personal lives and in the world in general at the moment, and we bemoan the lack of civility out there and the ignorance that we're seeing so often, it's the language that we're using at the moment changes. The language you use in public is very different. I often sort of describe it as unedited, because you're thinking off the hoof and you're sort of trying to formulate your ideas, and it's you sort of move and then you make a bit of a mistake and you make an apology for that. Whereas the language you use on social media is completely edited.
Yes.
You've thought about it for long and hard. You start using fairly aggressive words. You start trying to pick the word that you can use to make the most impact, etc. So you're almost sort of losing that element of editing, almost, you know, that vulnerability.
Yeah, I would counter that and say, is it sometimes long and thought about on social media? Sometimes you see, five or six years ago, probably even more recently than that, is writing stuff that really I probably didn't understand the depth to it. So we tend to say stuff that we don't know much about. It's a bit like the Dunning-Kruger effect, about saying, thinking we're really confident about a subject when actually we didn't know very little about it. And someone who's studied hormones for the last 7-8 years, I think I know a lot about it, but I'm literally scratching the surface of it. And so I think that perhaps we see that the newer generations coming through, and the lack of social contact, and sometimes the inability to communicate in groups is a problem, because some people are often scared of actually saying something, because they'll be deemed as being saying something that's really silly. And I think that might be an issue, and perhaps we're going down the wrong way with some of the social media and the contact, the use of smartphones, and how we tend to interact with society anyway. So I think it can be, if we can sit back and have a think about what somebody else is saying, it might not be within our belief system, but I think we need to actually question why they think like that, and whether it might be wrong or right is to come up with an approach that says, okay, that's fine. I don't believe that because I believe in these things, and we just can disagree. Whereas some people would be so intent, hammer and tongs, on proving someone wrong, and sometimes they don't actually have the depth to back that up. So I think it's a really interesting concept.
That the concept of agreeing to disagree seems to have gone out the window, isn't it?
It does. And I think what I like about science and studying is that in a lot of the circles, you can say, here's my argument, and you'll wait for something to come back and they'll disagree because there are other things, and it can be quite constructive sometimes, unless there are ulterior motives and different motivations for providing that particular type of research. But at least there's a scope for people to communicate and look at differences to come up with a greater purpose. But sometimes outside of more scientific circles, perhaps that doesn't happen because we're not interested in it perhaps finding out the truth. We're just more concerned about having our own point of view and being validated for that point of view.
Yeah.
And that's not constructive, I think, for a lot of areas.
Civil as ever. The good thing is that Keith and I always agree, so it's fine. Doesn't really matter. No need for disagreement here. Listen, I know you've got a busy day out and about, so we'll let you crack on with that one. If people have had their interest piqued, if people would like to get in touch, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, you can take a look at my website, balancedbodymind.com, or you can have email me, keith@balancedbodymind.com. I post lots of weird stuff that supports my biases and narratives on Instagram, Tomo Littlewood. That's pretty much it.
Good on you, fella. Thank you very much indeed for that one. All the best. Hopefully we'll see you before Christmas and, of course, the end of the year, so we can do sort of plaudits then.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tom.
This is Dubai Eye 103.8.